and limited his infinite ability by becoming a human being. Then last week, your Pastor Chris talked about how incarnation is servanthood, that by the God of all things choosing to do this, he was choosing to put himself in the position of being a servant, someone who is for us, and even, hard to imagine, below us, as a servant to us. But, as we, both of us, have tried to make clear in this series, you don't just believe in the incarnation of God's Son, Jesus, 2,000 years ago. That's only half of it. You also believe that the incarnation is the pattern or the model that Jesus left for all of us who choose to be Christians, who choose to be his followers. That's what that quote up there on the screen says in the white box. Two leaders in the missional church movement, churches like yours and mine. Jesus says very late in his life in the Gospel of John, "As the Father sent me into the world, so now I send you." What that means in ancient Greek is the same way that God sent me into the world, now I am sending you to be the same way, to act in the same way, to follow my example. So we are called to be present, to be limited and accept our limitations, and to be servants like him too. Today we want to return to my text for this series, which is just one verse out of the opening paragraph of the Gospel of John, where we have the subject of Jesus' incarnation talked about simply and yet profoundly. And it is this well-known verse 14 of John chapter 1, in which John says, "The Word," which is a way that he talks about Jesus, "the Word," or Jesus, "became flesh and made his dwelling among us," or literally, "pitched his tent among us." That's what we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Here's where we're going to pick it up today. "And we have beheld his glory, the glory of the one and only Son of God, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Now that first expression that we talked about a couple of weeks ago is profound enough on its own. It is, in fact, as if you recall, what makes this Christian belief distinct. Other religions 2,000 years ago believed that their gods came to earth in the form of animals or even human beings or monsters, but they didn't stay long. It was kind of a bender. It was a weekend in Vegas, if you will. What makes the Christian belief distinct, as expressed in this verse, is that Jesus chose to linger. He chose to stay. We think somewhere between 30 and 33 years, he stayed on planet Earth. He pitched his tent. That's what presence is about. That's what we talked about 2 weeks ago. Here's the catch, and this is where we start today. You and I, removed from this passage, don't understand that idea of pitching a tent the way that its original hearers or readers would have. Because that word in chapter 1, verse 14 of the Gospel of John refers to a specific tent, a singular tent, one tent. And those readers would have picked that up because the very next thing that John talks about is glory. And so these readers of John 1:14, who are very versed in the Old Testament, would have picked up, wow, I think he's talking about the most important tent in the story of the entire Bible. You know what tent I'm talking about? Forgive the flannel graph picture. Right? Anyone as old as me knows that in the 1970s, flannel graph in Sunday school was the equivalent of iPad, just with more lint. This is the only picture I could find that was decent of what we're talking about via a Google image search this week. That is the tabernacle in your Old Testament. And a reader well-versed with the Old Testament, like many of the original readers of John, would have picked up that when you marry together the idea of pitching a tent and God's glory, you're talking about that. You're talking about the tabernacle. Okay, now what's the tabernacle? For maybe those who don't recall those days of flannel graph in Sunday school like I do. Well, in the second book in your Bible, Exodus, God rescues the people of Israel from bondage in Egypt. And part of what he does for Israel is he travels with them from Egypt, the land of their captivity, to the promised land, what we now call Israel. And as he travels with them, he travels in the form of a tent called the tabernacle. And at nighttime, there was fire that shone over this tent. And in the daytime, there was a big billow of smoke that shone over the tent. And this was so that Israel always remembered that their God who delivered them was with them every hour, every day. In fact, he chose to dwell in a temple that could travel with them as they made their way from Egypt across the Sinai Peninsula to the promised land that he would give them. And John is saying, gosh, you know, you think that God traveling with his people in the Old Testament Israel was a big deal? And it was. It was this signature moment for them, this symbol of hope and stability for them, this reminder that God's power and presence was always with them. It was a huge deal. John says, now, God has come to earth like that, but not in the form of some tent with rich, luxurious fabric, golden implements and candelabras, the Ark of the Covenant. No. He came to earth as a man, a Middle Eastern man, who would have been, because of the nutrition of the day, shorter than almost everybody in the room, shorter than my 8th grade daughter, who is 5'7". He would have been darker complected than almost everybody in this room. He would have looked malnourished. His skin would have been wrinkled and hung from his bones. He probably didn't smell great because the hygiene 2,000 years ago was, shall we say, less than your standards. And yet, this Jewish rabbi, this Galilean revolutionary that we call Jesus Christ, was, according to God, the place that you went to see God's glory. This is where you saw God announced to the world, I am here. Don't forget, I am with you. My power and my presence are with you. I want you to think with me for a moment. If God's glory, which is kind of a very churchy expression, if it really just boiled down means God declaring to his people and the world that he is here, I want you to think for yourself for a minute. When have you had experiences of God's glory yourself? I have a very distinct memory of this in my own family's life. Within the first year of being married, my wife and I left seminary, which is pastor's graduate school. That's where we met. And we moved to our first pastorate, which is in Tucson, Arizona. And we got a weekend off. And someone in the church said, hey, you know, Heather, my wife, being a Texan, like all Texans, had never really left that state because they kind of think everywhere else is a foreign country. If she were here, she'd tell you, I'm telling you the truth. Well, she'd never seen anything in Arizona. So somebody in our church said, let me pay for you guys to have a weekend away. And we said, great, free, awesome. And we went up to the Grand Canyon. And if you've ever been to the Grand Canyon, when you approach it, when you approach the south rim of the Grand Canyon from Flagstaff, you kind of bend to the west, and all of a sudden the Grand Canyon appears out of nowhere. For mile after mile, it just looks like you're driving through the high desert, barren and arid. And then you bend to the left, and all of a sudden, there it is. And if you've never seen it, it is not like a little canyon. It is everywhere, as far as the eye can see from east to west. Pinks and oranges, colors that you cannot imagine. And my wife promptly drove off the road, because she had never seen anything like that before in her life. And so there we sit in a sagebrush in Grand Canyon National Park, because my beloved wife, Heather, was overwhelmed with the glory of God in the Grand Canyon that day. Now, what has done that for you? The birth of my first child did that for me. The birth of my second child, not so much. Kind of like his life. The birth of the life of my first child brings me much joy and attachment to God's glory. Second child, not so much. My first child is here this morning. She loves that part of the message. But birth of your child does that. You get this sense of God's transcendence and nearness to you, something that is bigger than you and mysterious. Nature does that for some of us. Art does that for some of us. Music does that for some of us. Music is huge for me in that way. A great conversation with a friend that gets below the superficial stuff of life and taps into the real grist of what's going on inside our souls, that will do it. All I'm saying to you is that you and I, no matter how inexperienced you are at spirituality, you have had moments when you have felt or sensed or seen God's glory. Here's the point. John is saying, you will never, I will never in my lifetime see God's glory or experience it any better than when I come close to Jesus. Because Jesus alone is God's new temple, his new tabernacle, the place where God's power and presence can be found. This is what you seek. Maybe you've had that experience too. Go back, by the way, to verse 14 of John 1, and I want you to catch how that last phrase in the verse fits with the theme of incarnation being glorious. So John says, in his very simple and yet profound way, that we believe Jesus became flesh, and that human being was God's new temple, full of God's divine glory. What marked Jesus as God's temple? What was, if you will, most glorious about Jesus if you and I had rubbed shoulders with him or seen him from afar 2,000 years ago? What's the last phrase? That Jesus, in a remarkable, hence before seen way, was full of grace and truth. And it was glorious. Jesus was God's new temple, full of his power and his presence. And what said that most about him was how gracious he was, how full of truth he was. There's another great verse in this opening paragraph to John's Gospel, verse 16 of John chapter 1, that presents a great image of this idea of Jesus being full of grace. It reads, "From Jesus' fullness, we have all received grace upon grace upon grace." The image there is that Jesus, the human Jesus, the person Jesus, is this water glass. And God the Father was pouring into him grace. Grace after grace after grace. And when that water, that grace got close to the rim, Jesus, God the Father did not stop pouring the grace. He just kept it coming. And it flowed over the brim of the glass and started to flood the counter and drip down onto the floor and soak the tablecloth. Because from Jesus' fullness, we have all received grace upon grace upon grace. Grace is a churchy word. What does grace actually mean? Grace means unmerited, undeserved favor and kindness. And apparently, if you and I had heard Jesus or encountered Jesus, one of the things that would have marked him the most is that he was a person like that, who always gave to everyone he encountered unmerited, undeserved favor and kindness. And it made him glorious. This is what you will, if you are a reader of John's Gospel, this is what you will observe Jesus doing over the next chapters of John's Gospel. In John chapter 3, only two chapters removed from this opening to the Gospel, a Jewish leader named Nicodemus will approach Jesus late at night because Nicodemus is afraid to ask his real spiritual questions of Jesus and lose his standing, lose his position as a leader, because others might think he's affiliating himself with this rabble-rouser. And there in the deep of night, instead of sleeping, Jesus receives one of his enemy to listen to his questions, to give him answers that will provoke and challenge and ultimately save Nicodemus. That's grace upon grace. In the next chapter, Jesus goes to Samaria and meets a woman at the well who has been divorced time and time again. So many times she's given up on marriage. Now she's just shacked up with somebody. And in Jesus' culture, he had no business as a Jewish man, let alone a Jewish religious teacher, talking to a woman like that. He should have shooed her away from the well so that he could get a cool drink. Instead, he says, "Come on over. Let's talk, you and me. And let me dump upon you grace upon grace upon grace. Undeserved favor and kindness. Change your life." At the end of John chapter 7 and the beginning of John chapter 8, he encounters another woman, this one caught in the act of adultery, infidelity, who is dragged before him to be stoned to death. And only Jesus, no one else, intervenes to save her life. Unmerited favor and kindness, and it changes her life. In the next chapter, a blind man encounters Jesus, and Jesus gives him sight and changes his life. But then Jesus whispers to him, "Don't forget, you think it's bad being physically blind, spiritually blind people? It's way worse." Over and over, Jesus dispenses grace, and it is glorious. Listening to Jesus' teaching, what you hear in what he taught other people and to us, the truthfulness of it is the same kind of thing. Maybe you've had that experience where you realize when you read through and you consider his parables or the Sermon on the Mount, there is something to what he's saying that will last. It is timeless. And that's why people gather in churches like this in the year 2015, 2,000 years removed from this man's life, and we still cling to his every word. Because it is divine, it is timeless, it is glorious truth. Jesus was full of grace and truth, and it was most glorious about him. I don't know why you're here this morning. A lot of people in West Michigan culture come because it's what's expected, or it's what your family did. Deep down, let me suggest to you, here's why you and I are here. Here's why after some 40-plus years of life, I still drag myself out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning and go to church to set up in a gymnasium, not for the paycheck, but because I need from Jesus to encounter God's glory, which is full of grace and truth, and you are no different. You need something. You need somebody in your life to give you that in a way that nothing else can. And I have good news for you. If the Jesus you have heard about, if the Jesus you were taught as a child, if the Jesus other Christians in your life talk about doesn't sound like he's full of grace and truth, it's not Jesus. It's something else. It is a terrible caricature of what Jesus really was. Jesus is glorious. God's new temple on the earth, full of grace and truth. And that's why people like us still seek him out. It does not, however, end there. This is a verse from the same gospel, so you know they're connected. This is the last night of Jesus' life. This is, in fact, his last act, the very last thing he does before he leaves the upper room with his disciples and goes to the Garden of Gethsemane to pray, to struggle, to be arrested, and ultimately executed on a Roman cross. The last thing he does is he prays. We call this his high priestly prayer, and it's recorded in the Gospel of John, chapter 17. One of the things in this prayer that he does is he prays for us. He prays for his followers. And I'd like you to notice, please, the first phrase of what he prays for us. And really, you can only let this sink in. You can only grab onto the gravity of what he's saying now that we have talked about him being full of God's glory, which was gracious and true. Jesus prays for us, his followers, I have given them the glory that you, Father, have given me. Now, the rest of that verse, by the way, is awesome too, but we're only going to talk about that first phrase. Jesus prays for us and says his purpose is to give us, his followers, the same glory that God gave him. Wow. Pause with me for a minute. This causes me to ask some very important questions. Like, is that how I think of myself? And is that how I think of you? Do I think of myself as someone, because I am a follower of Jesus, that Jesus has given his glory to? In the same way that God's glory shone in him and was heard in him as if he were a walking, living, breathing temple full of grace and truth. Yeah, that's what he wants to give me too. It seems as if he's saying, as the great American poet Maya Angelou puts it, every person in the room is someone who, quote, is trailing wisps of divine glory. Is that how I think of myself? Let's pause for a moment and examine human self-talk. You know what self-talk is? These are the conversations you have about yourself in your head that nobody else has access to. If you're an introvert, like really never anybody has access to it. If you're an extrovert, maybe you'll talk about it sometimes, like when you get angry or frustrated. What's your self-talk like? How do you talk about yourself to yourself? Well, some of you talk to yourself about yourself in terms of your successes. These are the pat yourself on the back part of the room. And so you're happy with yourself that you got the new raise or the new position at work, and you're glad for what that added income is going to allow your family to do. This is not a bad thing. Or if you're someone who's a parent in the room, a lot of times it's not your own success, it will be the success of your children. And you think, whatever else in my life it is that I am messing up, and Lord knows the list is long, at least my children are succeeding. And therefore I can feel good about myself. Let me go ahead and revisit that, my two children thing, and say, yeah, there's one of my kids that I'm doing a better job with than the other, but I think I'm blaming my second child for how bad he's turning out. In our self-talk, we define ourselves by our successes, but then you can flip that. There are other people in the room who define themselves by their failures, whether they're current failures or past failures. And the worst that you have done or the worst that you have said Or, in some cases, the pains that have been inflicted on you are really the thing that you return to over and over again when you talk about yourself to yourself. Another very common one is stress and anxiety and worries. And all the things that we have to do or all the things that could go wrong are the things that we talk to ourselves about in our head when we're alone. Right? All that is well and good. I understand. Here's what's missing. You're glorious. And that is not just my opinion, because I don't know many of you. Maybe you're not. But that's what Jesus said. He said that he came to give his glory to his followers. Do you think he was wrong? Or were you just the person who showed up late, were last in line, and he was out by the time you got there? Or do you really think that what he said is true of every person here, including you? That you, in some small way, but yet you in some beautiful, illuminating way, to rival the greatest sunset or the Grand Canyon itself, are glorious, just like he was glorious. Maybe this week what you need to do is you need to spend some time looking and seeing what's glorious about you. Not to stroke your ego, but to take Jesus at his word that there is something beautiful and profound and touching and spiritually enlightening about you. I get it. You don't have it all together. You never will. Relax, type A. It's okay. But you are glorious because Jesus said he wanted to share that with you. Can you see that in other people too? Yet, your husband is not just the guy who refuses to do the to-do list at home. Your wife is not a nag. Your children are not just their lack of doing their homework. Your co-workers are not their profanity, if they happen to be a Christian person and a follower of Jesus too. The people here are not just people who sit near you or across the aisle from you or work in the same ministry as you. Know, they bear God's glory the same way Jesus did, and he's decided to share that with you and with me. Can you see that in the people here? If you don't, you're completely undervaluing. You're underselling who you are. Maybe one of the things you can do this week and periodically is you just need to pause. You need to write little notes to people or emails to people and say, hey, this is how I see God in you. This is what you have done or what you have said that maybe nobody else saw, but I did. This is what's glorious about you. Don't miss it. Because I'm guessing that many of you are like me. And when I look at that up on the screen, I go, wow, I've spent most of my life not finding Jesus' glory in me or the others around me, and I'm tired of it. This seems far better, far more empowering, far more uplifting, and far more true to the mission of Jesus. And by the way, because we did our homework on John chapter 1, verse 14, you know what makes a person glorious. You know what makes them radiate with God's power and presence as if they were a walking, talking temple of God more than anything else, just like Jesus. It's when they're full of grace and truth, just like he was. If you want to be someone who feels about themselves or senses about themselves that you are imbued with God's glory, you have to be committed to being a person of grace and truth. If you want to see that in other people, you need to have eyes that see grace and truth. Grace. How can you become a person of grace? Do you have the courage to treat people in a way that is compassionate and kind and merciful when they don't deserve it. Because by definition, that's grace. And I got news for you. Maybe you know this before I say it. But let me say it so it's clear in the room. Most of the people around you in your life, your family, your friends, your neighbors, the other parents of the kids at your kids' school, they are only treated according to merit. When they do something that's nice, when they do something that's right, when they do something that's good, they are applauded for it and they are thanked for it. But when they make a mistake, or when they don't put their best foot forward, or they aren't on their A game some certain day, they are not treated the same way. They are looked down upon. They're ridiculed behind their back. They're talked poorly about in a string of emails in which they are not included, and on down the line. And you've experienced this too. We all know what it's like to be treated well on our good days. Very few of us know what it's like to be treated well on our bad days. And if you want to be a person of grace, you have to be committed to treating people compassionately and lovingly, not because they deserve it, but because it's right. And moreover, the reason we know it's right, it's what we see in Jesus. He took people for who they were. All the bruises, all the scars, all the imperfections, and showered them with grace upon grace upon grace. I am thoroughly convinced there is not much that will make you feel closer to God than treating someone who doesn't deserve it with grace. Just like this is the same spiritual genius that Jesus uses at the end of Matthew 5, where he tells you to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. There is nothing that will melt your heart like having to do that. And it is hard work when you do. Grace is the same way. If you want to be a person who is glorious, full of God's presence and power, you have to choose the way of grace. Can you do that? You have to choose the way of truth. Here's the thing. When people come to you and they seek you out for advice, or they have a question for you about something of substance, a life issue, be it parenting or marriage or finances, or they're wrestling with a doubt about the Christian faith, let me tell you what they really need to hear from you. And you could be an extraordinarily wise person. I'm sure that a lot of people in the room are. The longer you're with Jesus, he tends to produce that in you. So I'm sure that your perspective has a lot to offer. This is not in the end what they need from you. Because long after, even short after, you and I are dead, what you and I have said is not going to last. Maybe our kids will remember. I hope my kids will remember at least one or two things that I have taught them over the course of their life, when I am long gone. But I do know what they will remember. And they will remember the truth that has lasted now 2,000 years, that was in Jesus, that was given to him by the Father. He was full of it. And it's why I return to him time and time again. And it's also what the people around you seek. Can you, in those moments, those spiritually poignant moments, can you point people to the truth of Jesus? This assumes you can do that for yourself. Look, release yourself from the guilt of not knowing all the answers. You never will, and neither will I. But if you've been around here long enough, you've heard enough about Jesus, you've heard who he was and what he went about, what his teachings were, what his moral principles were, what his spiritual principles were, what his priorities were. You know enough that in that moment, you can point the people who seek you out to him. And you can say, I have found divine truth in this man and what he said. And I think you will too. And in that moment, you being full of truth will be glorious. Other people will not just see you. They will not just hear you. They will hear God through you. They will see God in you. They will hear the very voice of Jesus in you. If you and I want to be bearers of Jesus' glory, there is no other way to do it than to be committed to being people of grace and of truth. What do you believe, Christian person, about incarnation? Well, biblically speaking, to believe in the incarnation is to believe in that. You believe it is glorious. And you should be too. I don't know who it is that has shaped you in your faith. I'm a firm believer that I would want any Christian who calls my congregation home or you in this congregation to have people in your life. Could be writers, could be people here at the branch, could be people from Christianity's past who have shaped you, who have blazed the trail before you on which you now walk, and they point the way for you. She is one of those people for me. She changed my life. The late Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who often, when you read what she said in her journals and letters and elsewhere, will be able to put things down into a nutshell in a way that I frankly can't. And about this idea of all people, you and I now being able to share Christ's glory, you and I being able to see it in other people, if we just have the eyes to look, she says that this way. I believe that the spiritual life is only lived person to person. Every person is Christ for me. And since there is only one Jesus, that person with whom I'm interacting is the one person in the world at that moment when I'm with them. I see Christ in every person I touch. It is as simple as that. How extraordinary. Can you imagine living that way? To believe that what Jesus said in John 17 is true? That when you encounter people, if you have the heart and the eyes to see it, you can see His glory. You can tell Him so. You can share your own. I want that life. Do you? Would you pray with me? Our Father in heaven, today, this Advent season, we celebrate together Jesus, His coming to us. And specifically today that You sent Him to pitch a tent here among us, to be full of Your glory, which was gracious and true. And now, Father, we wrestle with His prayer for us, that now He sends us into the world to be glorious for others too. Father, this week, help us to see ourselves and understand ourselves as those who carry His glory. And maybe more importantly, give us the eyes and the hearts to see His glory in others, to tell them about it, to encourage it. Father, as we do this, change our lives, redeem us from who we were into who You are making us to be. This, Father, we ask for the sake of Your kingdom. Amen.
Is it on? I'll share. Thanks, Chris. As we prepare to share communion together, and I invite you to hear these words from John 1 one more time. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. This meal shows us grace and truth. Grace is everywhere we look and touch and taste. The bread points us to Christ's body, which was willingly broken and given up for us. Is there an act more full of grace and truth and glory? But it's not just that Jesus was broken. It's also that he invites us to bring our brokenness, to come as we are and find this grace for us.
Grace and truth. Truth is everywhere we look and touch and taste. The cup points us to Christ's blood poured out, which Jesus tells us is a sign of truth.